This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Okay, everybody. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. This is again your host, Charles Giuliani. We're joined by a very important and special guest this evening. His name is Richard Falk. He's actually a UN human rights representative of Palestine, the representative of Palestine. So he's going to be sharing some very important and I'm sure disturbing information with us about the plight of the Palestinians. This is something that we've talked about before in the show, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it a lot more in the future. This has been an ongoing problem from day one since the creation of the State of Israel, and it's not only not getting better, it's actually getting worse. Welcome to the show, Mr. Falk. Wouldn't you agree? It seems to be getting worse.
Sadly, it is. Each time I go to the area, I think it's gotten as bad as it can get. And the next time I realize it's gotten significantly worse. And increasingly, the United States is held to be very responsible for this posture of unconditionally supporting Israel, no matter how much it defies international law, international morality, and even political prudence. So it is a very unfortunate chapter in American foreign policy and our own courage to be respectful of the dignity of other people.
Absolutely. I tell you what, there's so many things I want to ask you about, but before we even get into that, talk about this in more detail, I wanted to ask you, how did you actually wind up becoming the UN Human Rights Representative for Palestine?
Surprise to me, frankly, I was proposed in Geneva and asked in advance if I would accept it if the Human Rights Council designated me as the special rapporteur, what they call special rapporteur for Palestine. And I didn't think much about it because I was pretty sure I wouldn't be selected, partly because you have to be unanimously endorsed by the 49 governments that were members of the Human Rights Council. And at that time, the United States was boycotting the council. It was during the Bush presidency. And if the U.S. had been a member as it is now, I certainly wouldn't have been selected. So,
what kind of background, if you don't mind me asking, did you have prior to this time that you were even considered for the position?
Well, I am trained as an international law expert. I had taught for 40 years at Princeton University and held a chair in international law. And I had written relatively extensively on both issues of war and peace and issues pertaining to the Middle East, including the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Do you see, I guess if you look at the UN's voting record, that would kind of answer my question. I was going to ask, do you think that there's a popular sentiment in favor of the Palestinians over the abuses of the Israelis? So I guess that kind of answers the question. But at the same time, there's been, a very disappointing lack of action on the part of the UN. We've seen some positive results with voting, but nothing happens to us.
You're completely right, Charles. I mean, you have two things that are important to keep in mind about the UN. It can do important things on a symbolic level that determine the legitimacy of some claims and some grievances. And it's done that from time to time. with respect to Palestine. But what it can't do is be behaviorally effective if the geopolitical forces are active in blocking it. If they're active in promoting it, as they were in relation to Libya in 2011, then they can be very effective. Then the UN becomes a very potent actor, maybe too potent. But if, as in the case with Israel, the U.S. uses its geopolitical muscle, it can effectively prevent the UN from doing anything that affects the situation on the ground. It cannot, as I say, prevent these important symbolic struggles for the high moral and legal ground. And the UN is very important in playing that role. It played that role in relation to racist South Africa and helped to turn the tide in public opinion and eventually in the balance of forces within South Africa itself.
Now, would you attribute a lot of this inactivity, not acting on, you know, these unanimous votes against the abuses of Israel over the years, would you attribute a lot of that to the United States' vetoing power?
Yes, I attribute it significantly, you know, 50% at least to the U.S., but also to the degree to which Western Europe tends to follow the U.S., and to some degree even Japan tends to follow the U.S. So it's not, those countries also have some significant responsibility for not acting in accordance with the with justice in relation to this conflict. Germany is still recovering from the traumas of the Holocaust. European liberal democracies did too little to help the Jews during that period, and so there's a kind of lingering sense of guilt, and anything that is perceived to be anti-Israeli is immediately labeled as anti-Semitism by sure. Zionist forces around the world. You know that.
I'm sure
phenomenon.
You've been labeled that.
Yes, of course. Despite my being a Jew myself.
Oh, you are Jewish. Okay. Interesting.
Yes, yes, I'm not particularly religious, but I'm I am Jewish and was brought up in New York City.
Actually, I should have known that because I knew Peter Falk, the actor, was also Jewish. I don't imagine there's any right. relation.
Yeah, no, he's no relation, though. He's the more famous Falk, so I'm often confused with him.
Well, you might beat that record if you keep going the way you're going here. It sounds like you're very determined, and that's just what we need, you know, for this cause here.
I think the reason that I've agreed to do it, it's an unpaid position and it's a lot of work, but and you get a lot of hostile feedback. But I feel that the Palestinians deserve some voice that speaks truly to their situation, and I've tried to be as honest and accurate as it's possible to be in this role.
It's really unpaid. I didn't realize that. Wow.
Yes, the advantage of it, there's a kind of trade-off. It's unpaid, but it's independent, which means that I can't be easily... I'm not subject to...
Can't buy you off so easily, yeah.
And I've been attacked, actually, by even the Secretary General as being overly critical of Israel, or this one of these Zionist organizations accused me of being a 9/11 truther, and they wrote this to Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador, and she attacked me, and some Canadian and British ministers have attacked me. So it's a very contested territory, I'm afraid.
So you've actually brought into question some of the inconsistencies with the official 9/11 story?
Well, what I did was to say that there are unanswered questions. I don't know enough myself to have a firm position. I am a friend of David Ray Griffin, who's probably the leading critic, and I wrote the foreword to his first book on 9/11.
Oh, I didn't know that. No kidding. Oh, so you've been questioning this for a while, then.
I beg your pardon?
You've been questioning some of the problems with 9/11 for a while. Yeah.
Yes. As I say, though, I have never penetrated the controversy sufficiently to have an independent judgment, but I respect him very much as an honest and diligent and talented scholar who is absolutely convinced that there are huge gaps in the official version.
So have you ever raised any questions in the presence of the Security Council? I don't know if you've ever spoken before them or...
No, they tried to arrange for me to speak. There again, the U.S. has enough clout that that kind of prominence is not available to me, unfortunately.
Sure. And if it was, the mic would probably cut out that day.
Probably. At best, that's the least I could hope for.
Yeah, right. Yeah, really. But, yeah, I understand you've had some threats. I imagine you've had a lot of people. I'm sure you've been called a self-hating Jew.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it's a shame in that sense that people in this country particularly have been so slow to realize that we're really... In this kind of support of Israel, we're really going against the current of history, especially the whole decolonization movement that has really produced independent countries in the former colonial world almost everywhere except in historic Palestine, where Israel has to be viewed as a remnant of the colonial period, and even though it's established as a kind of settler society, to deny Palestinians their own self-determination in their own land should be viewed not only as a moral outrage, but as a effort to veto history itself.
Sure. Now, the Palestinians themselves, how do they take that you represent them before the UN, being Jewish? You know what I mean? Is that a problem for any of them? Are they suspicious, or do they welcome you with welcoming arms? Or
they, of course, it's complicated to understand who represents the Palestinians, and there's controversy over whether the Palestinian Authority, which is the group that is recognized by Israel and by the U.S., is sufficiently independent itself to provide the Palestinians with the kind of authentic voice that they deserve within the international community. Hamas, which is the Palestinian group that governs in Gaza, has been listed as terrorist organization, even though it's tried in recent years to be acknowledged as a political actor and seems ready to enter into serious negotiations for a just compromise in the conflict. So one has a very divided Palestinian reality, which is deliberately generated by Israel in part over the years. But to answer your question directly, no, I haven't encountered from any of these various Palestinian tendencies any objection to me, to myself as a Jew. In fact, to some degree, I think they are glad that it is a way for them to show that indeed they're not anti-Semitic, and that they, and I felt very much in a genuine way that I've been accepted as a person for who I am, and that they appreciate the fact that I get a lot of flack as a self-hating Jew because of this effort to identify with them and their struggle.
It seems there's more animosity on the part of, you know, the real hardcore Zionists, more animosity toward Jews who, you know, expose Zionism than non-Jews.
Yes, it's a kind of sense of a tribal betrayal, you know, that you or tribal treason that you are not willing to fall into line. And I've always felt in criticizing the U.S. government that I'm being a loyal American and a citizen that acts out of conscience, not a subject who is shows his allegiance by mere obedience.
Blind loyalty, yeah.
Yeah, the difference between, I think relatively few Americans understand the difference between being a subject and being a citizen.
Yeah.
Most Americans, unfortunately, are subjects, and they think patriotism is equivalent to blind obedience.
Yeah.
And I've been arguing all my adult life that citizenship implies a responsibility to act on the basis of conscience and legality and to be willing to criticize your own government for what they do that's wrong.
And criticizing one's government doesn't make you against your country. In fact, if you're for your country, very often you have to criticize your government.
That's my point. That's my point. And but it's sad that that understanding, which was very much part of Thomas Jefferson's view of the relationship between government and society, is just not very widely understood or respected in this country. I think it did get some respect for a while during the anti-war movement in the Vietnam period.
Right.
But since then, I think the society has become so
apathetic,
preoccupied with materialist consumerism and the problems of economic survival in this very unfair domestic economy that we have, that it's in many ways understandable that many people can't see the larger forest and are preoccupied with their particular tree in the forest.
And worse, they don't seem to care even when it's pointed out to them. You know, issues don't seem to concern them like this, like they used to. Yeah, it's very sad.
And, of course, the corporatized media is significantly complicit in this because it doesn't present, for instance, the Palestinian side of the conflict in an objective way. It suppresses news about Israeli abuses. It exaggerates news about Palestinian alleged wrongs. And so it's quite understandable that many people in this country don't understand the conflict. But I would say, even having acknowledged that, that the public is more aware of Palestinian victimization than are the people inside the Beltway in Washington that have been so corrupted by AIPAC and by the Israeli lobby and by their counter-press that they are completely able to perform as representatives of the people should perform.
Yeah, there's a completely disproportionate influence on the part of AIPAC, unquestionably. There's something I'm really curious about. How do you feel about the criticism that you've been getting from the Israeli press as compared to the United States press? For example, as I'm sure you're aware, there's been a lot of criticism of the Israeli government in the pages of Haaretz and Jerusalem Post, far more than anything I've ever seen in American media.
Yes, I think that the debate for a long time has been more open in Israel than here, even though I would say that it's becoming a little bit more even-handed here. It's possible to say things that are irreverent toward Israel. It was done, for instance, at the Academy Awards event a few nights ago, where I was really quite surprised by two things. One, that two documentary films that were rather critical of Israel were both nominated as finalists in the selection for documentary film. Five Broken Cameras and Gatekeepers, both important films. Neither of them got the award, but the fact that they were nominated was significant. Sure. And the Master of Ceremonies made some kind of jokes about Hollywood. How do you get ahead in Hollywood if you're not a Jew? Which was there's a little bit of change of tone in this country.
Well, Saturday Night Live did a skit recently. I don't know if you're aware of it, but they were making fun of, you know, the way there's a lot of kissing up, I guess you could say, in Congress with Israel. That was surprising.
Yes, I think it's a there is a small change, but the problem is it's not reaching Washington in a way that will change policy. And
right.
Obama's been disappointing, partly because his priorities are elsewhere. He's concerned with issues like immigration and taxation and the fiscal cliff, so-called. And for that reason, he doesn't want to agitate the pro-Israeli constituencies in this country.
Sure, and from which a lot of the money flows.
Yes, but it's unfortunate because he would be able to get significant backing from the American people if he went outside the Beltway and said it's time for us to really change the way in which we relate to this conflict.
Yeah.
We owe it to ourselves, we owe it to the people of Palestine, we owe it to the people of Israel.
I mean, Washington certainly fills us with plenty of rhetoric about being concerned to stop human rights abuses. We supposedly intervene in other countries to stop it. Where is that here?
But we don't intervene in our own country or in Israel.
Yeah, right. There was an instance, I think it was back in the 1970s, where the UN had actually voted to label Zionism as racism. Do you recall that? And then later, in the 90s.
Yes, that was in mid-90s, I think 1975, actually.
Yeah.
The Zionism is racism. And, of course, that I don't think that was the right way to go, in a sense that it created a diversionary issue and sort of gave some credibility to those that said Zionism is really anti-Semitism and anti-Israel. It confused the issues, I think. I think it's diversionary especially in the UN, not to focus on the rights of the Palestinian people, the inalienable right to their self-determination that's been denied for decades, not to focus on the fact that there's several million Palestinians that have been living for generations as refugees under generally intolerable conditions of statelessness, and that what little prospect there is for a Palestinian independent state is continuously being eroded by Israel building unlawful settlements that we have ourselves. The U.S. government has, from the outset, said they were unlawful, and yet at the same time has argued that they need to be validated in any peace agreement.
Right.
So they're kind of contradictions wherever you look.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What's been going on? I guess there's been some quite a few violent protests due to there's been torture and I guess some killings that have been going on recently. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, Well, there's been a very important incident, which is that a young Palestinian who is a gas attendant in the West Bank was arrested and apparently tortured and died in detention. And the Israelis initially said he died of heart attack, but the autopsy observed by a Palestinian showed that he had no heart problems and that his body was significantly bruised in a way that indicated rather severe torture. And this has provoked, as one might expect, very vigorous protests on the West Bank and has given rise to the sense that there could easily be a new cycle of continuous and organized protest in both the West Bank and possibly in Gaza as well.
And it's amazing because,
one other thing to mention here is that there are many other problems with the Israeli way of detaining and imprisoning Palestinians in a manner that is not consistent with international humanitarian law. In protest against this, there are four Palestinian prisoners who are on the edge of death, having carried on hunger strikes for periods up to almost astonishingly up to 200 days, and are really in severe danger of dying. And that this has led to mass hunger strikes from prisoners that are not in danger, but are doing this in solidarity. But we never hear, this is where the media silence is deafening. We never hear about nonviolent resistance of this sort in the reporting of the conflict. You remember in the 1980s, the hunger strikes in Northern Ireland were given worldwide daily publicity. And yeah, the Palestinians are constantly being told if they were nonviolent in their pursuit of political independence, then they would get a big audience in the West and in the United States. But in fact, unless they're violent, they're ignored completely.
Yeah, it's sad because the general impression Americans have is that Palestinians are the instigators and the Israelis are always the victims, you know, and it's just such a twisted bunch of propaganda.
It's the exact opposite of the truth. And, you know, the same thing is true of American Indians or indigenous Native Americans. They're only newsworthy if they're violent. And then they're stereotyped as being violent.
Right.
And if they're not violent, they're ignored.
Very much the same thing went on here, sure. And as a matter of fact, it's not in the past. You know, the U.S. government still continues to renege on treaties that, you know, it's signed with the Native Americans. They're still getting shafted to this day in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
The death of, I'm sure you knew, Russell Means there. That was a tragedy.
Yeah,
he just died recently. Yeah. He was a good man. He was a loss to everybody, not just the Native Americans, you know, the Sioux particularly. Anyway, but coming back to my question about the difference between the Israeli press, the U.S. press, do you find that you have a more favorable review in the Israeli press than you do in the U.S.? Are you attacked more there, do you think? Or?
Well, I think they take more notice of me there, and by and large, the more Zionist elements in the media do attack me more vigorously here, more or less ignored, except by these very dedicated Zionist NGOs and that try to create difficulties for me to to the extent they can.
Sure.
But the press doesn't report. Their strategy is essentially to ignore anyone that is critical of Israel unless some kind of major incident occurs that they can't overlook. But they don't.
How about in the European press? Is there? Would you say there's more open-mindedness? Are people more willing to listen in Europe than say here?
Oh yes, there's no question. It's a dramatic difference between Europe and here. Although, as I say, it's better here than it was 5 years ago, and there's more awareness within universities and I think within churches than there was a few years ago. There is a change of mood, and there is, I think, a wider and wider recognition among more educated people that it is the Palestinians who are the victims and Israel that is the perpetrator,
right,
of most of the abuse that is taking place in the conflict, and that Israel is not ready or willing to give a fair peace to the Palestinians, and therefore the idea of negotiations is a cruel joke, in effect.
Hopefully the trend is going to continue. We're going to see more awakening and more criticism over the airwaves without having to use the Trump card of victimization as though, you know, Israel has always been a victim in this conflict, because certainly that's not the case. Anyway, we got to cut to a short break, but stick with us, folks. We'll be right back with our guest, Robert Falk.
Good, Richard.
I'm sorry, Richard Falk. Sorry about that.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction, as guests from various realms of interest share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana, and it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. To learn how you can help, go to normal.org.
Come, you masters of war.
Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan. America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together.
The build, destroy.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. We're joined again by Richard Falk. I made the mistake of calling him Robert Falk. When you do live radio, anything can go wrong, and usually does. Anyway, in the second half hour, of course, we're going to still continue to talk about what's going on in Palestine. Very interesting and important inside information. It's not often that we actually get somebody who's there in the front lines who can speak firsthand of issues that are going on. So this is a rare treat. Also during this half hour, though, I want to be taking some, we got some questions that I got coming in via text. I'll be reading off, as well as some other highlight points that I wanted to hit. But, you know, before we even do that, do you have any website, Richard, or any, have you written any books or anything you'd like to share with us where our listeners can go and read up on some of the work that you do?
Well, I think probably the most relevant thing is I have a blog that deals with a lot of these issues that we've been talking about and tries to deal with my understanding of various conflicts going on in the world. And that can be found at richardfalk.wordpress.com. And I'm glad to respond to people who send in comments. And it's been, I think, a quite good interactive venue for people with an interest in these issues. I also wanted to recommend highly a book that's about to be published, and I think gives anyone with a 30% open mind an understanding of this conflict. It's written by a young woman named Pamela Olson, and the title is Fast Times in Palestine, A Love Affair with a Homeless Homeland. And she's a young American, recent graduate of Stanford University, that went to the Middle East and literally fell in love with Palestine in a way that I think makes one aware of what the human tragedy is, that we're destroying a great people and a society that has existed on this land, this holy land, for generations. And I just feel that if Americans could read a book like this, it's the next best thing to actually experiencing what the reality is. So I really urge people, if they can, to get this book. It's just published. It's a paperback, and you can find it through Amazon. Her name is Pamela Olson. And the title is Fast Times in Palestine. I know you'll enjoy reading it because it's extremely well written and has a lot of humor, among other things.
Excellent. I have to look into that. So let's talk about, and then I'll get to the questions here soon, but what's been going on with the Israeli elections? That's one of the talking points I had here that I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah, well, the Israeli election was interesting in the sense that it showed a kind of unexpected disapproval of the Netanyahu leadership. It did indicate some support for renewing negotiations with the Palestinians, but at the same time, it also indicated that the general drift of Israeli politics to the extreme right is continuing. And I don't think that there is in the near future any prospect of an Israeli government that is willing to jeopardize the continuing expansion of unlawful Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And without doing something to roll back this unlawful settlement dynamic, there's no opportunity to find a solution based on two states coexisting side by side in peace and sovereignty.
How about the UN fact-finding mission on illegal settlements, what has come out of that?
Well, I think a very clear set of conclusions, not surprising to someone like myself, but the recommendations are somewhat encouraging. They include the sense that these are unlawful, that their products and efforts to become economically self-sufficient should be boycotted by the international community. the corporations that do business with these settlements should also be boycotted, and that's something that I've also proposed in my most recent report to the UN. There are a number of prominent American companies that are engaged in profitable business arrangements with settlements on the West Bank, and these really should be opposed by people of goodwill and conscience.
And again, you do see popular support within the UN for these measures, correct?
Oh, there's overwhelming support, and that's what. See, if the UN was even moderately democratic, there would be strong solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. It's only because the UN is this mixture of a organization representing the peoples of the world and an organization that is funded and overwhelmingly influenced by the rich and powerful, what I call the geopolitical actors, and particularly the United States.
It's pretty sad that it works that way, but that's pretty much across the board how politics works on all levels.
Yes, it's. I mean, there's a lot of confusion with respect to the UN because people tend to fall into two groups. One is saying we should let the UN solve all our problems, and the other one that says the UN is useless and worthless. And in my view, neither group is correct. I think that on the one side, the UN is very important in waging these legitimacy struggles that are very psychologically influential in public opinion and generally in shaping global policy. And at the same time, to look to the UN to solve these problems is naive and unrealistic, because the UN cannot act in any manner that challenges the geopolitical muscle of the United States and, to some extent, other big powers in the world.
And there's also the concern that, you know, the UN has been, to some degree anyway, a Zionist tool, even though, of course, there's been popular sentiment against Israel voting. You know, the argument is, well, yeah, but it's a toothless tiger. We're not seeing anything. You know, they'll point to the UN having given so much land to Israel. You know, what gave them the authority to do that right from the word go?
You're right. See, the UN was playing a quasi-colonial game, and the whole claim of Jewish people to a homeland was given validation after World War I, not by anything that happened in historic Palestine, but by the British Foreign Office.
Yeah,
the Balfour Declaration.
Sure.
And now we live with a reality that there is a Israeli state, and there are Palestinian people. Very few are saying this Israeli state has to be dismantled. What they are saying is that there needs to be some kind of solution that incorporates the Palestinian people, that Sure. can either come about through creating a genuine independent state within the 1967 borders, or it can be created by establishing a single secular state that has the boundaries of historic Palestine, the British mandate over Palestine, and would allow both peoples to live under a democratic constitutional arrangement with human rights guaranteed for both peoples.
That certainly would be a welcome sight to see that. I tell you what,
and it would be a great contribution to the U.S. Role in the Middle East, in the world. There's nothing that brings more resentment toward the United States than its policy toward this conflict. which is increasingly viewed in the rest of the world as the great moral issue of our time.
Right. Absolutely. In the last 10 or so minutes we have, I'm hoping to get to some of the questions that we have coming in here via text. But before we do that, we actually have a live caller on line two. Did you want to go to a caller, Richard?
Sure.
Sure. Okay, let's take our call here on line two. Welcome to the show, caller.
Hello.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead. You got a question, Richard?
Yes, I do. My question to him is, what can we do as far as going around the American media and actually being able to get into the American media with more honesty and factuality of what happens on the ground in Palestine? How can we do that?
It's not easy, of course, because the media is tied increasingly to the corporate infrastructure that is in turn tied to the U.S. government, and therefore it's very difficult to challenge that directly. So I think at the same time, it's worth doing what can be done locally and nationally to continue to try to penetrate the media by letters, op-ed columns, by speaking out to the extent one can. I mean, we still enjoy here some limited democratic freedoms, and we need to use them. And the more agitation there is, the more people will feel courageous enough to say the truth as it has been increasingly evident that the Palestinians are being denied their fundamental rights, that the United States is backing a very oppressive and right-wing Israeli government that ignores international law, and that we're paying a great price in the pursuit of our own national interest by this unconditional support of Israel.
Caller, was that it?
No. Also, now the grip of the Zionist state, but not only the Zionist state, but also the geopolitical movement that's here in the United States. Do you think that there is possibly a revolution on hand, or a movement towards that direction, as far as you see?
Well, I think the objective situation should suggest that there is a revolutionary situation, not only for these reasons, but because of the economic injustice of the way in which the benefits of economic growth are being so unequally distributed. But I don't think there, at this point, is a sufficient mobilization of popular opposition. Most of the energy is on the, most of the political energy is on the extreme right, represented by the Tea Party. And unfortunately, progressive and more open-minded political forces have not been able to shape a coherent program of opposition up to this point.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Anyway, caller, I'll let you go for now because we got several more questions I want to have Richard address before the show's over in just about 5 minutes. We got a question coming in from Jimmy in Georgia, and he asks, does the guest think that Obama is a Republican in his actions and policies, not much different than Bush?
I do think that there are significant similarities, especially in the area of national security, particularly in relation to the conflict we've been discussing, the Israel-Palestine conflict, the way in which the drones have been used even to kill an American citizen. There is a disappointing continuity between the Obama presidency and the Bush presidency. I think Obama's more decent in relation to many domestic issues. He has more of a feeling for economic, social, and political justice here. He appoints better people to the courts. I think he wants a fairer taxation system than was the case under Bush and for the Republicans. I think he's more committed to entitlements of Social Security, health care, and the like. But as far as foreign policy is concerned, I don't see very significant differences between the two parties.
Yeah, precious little difference, unfortunately. Let's see. We've got another question from Mike in California. He asks, can Richard speak about the bullying tactics of the U.S. against the U.N., more specifically the recent threat of defunding U.N. programs if Palestine was recognized by the U.N.?
Yes. I mean, I think that this reveals the extent to which the U.S. Is prepared to go to support unreasonable, even outrageous Israeli claims that the UN has no right to decide on its own such matters as whether the Palestinian Authority should be viewed as representing the state of Palestine. That was the decision reached last November 29th by the overwhelming vote in the General Assembly. And to threaten to defund the UN because it doesn't conclude the way Israel wants the U.S. to push in the organization is to suggest how poor a citizen we are of the UN, that we like it only when it does what we want it to do, as it did in the Libyan intervention in 2011. That's not the kind of UN that serves the peoples of the world, and I would maintain is not good in the long run for the United States itself. We need an organization that's guided by considerations of global justice, international law, a commitment to maintaining peace and to recognizing the rights of all peoples that share life on this planet.
Excellent. We got two more. I'll see if I can squeeze them in. This is from Tim, somewhere in the U.S. He asks, and this is kind of a broad question. It's not going to be easy to give a short answer to this one, but do you feel that Israel exerts control on U.S. banks, media, and politicians?
Well, it is a broad question. I frankly don't know enough to give an intelligent answer. Certainly there's an impression that directly or indirectly Zionist forces inhibit and do exert an unhealthy influence in many sectors of American life,
sure,
and that this is not good for our future as a country.
Yeah, that's not open for question, no doubt about it. One more question. Rob in California asks, what is the status of the UN recognition of Palestine at this time?
The UN General Assembly upgraded the Palestinian Authority presence in the organization from being an observer to being a non-member state. And that entitles it to seek access to other parts of the UN system, including the International Criminal Court and International Court of Justice, as a sovereign state. And that is potentially an important development.
Sure. How recent was that declaration?
November 29th, 2012.
Oh, so just a few months ago. That's actually, that, yes, is significant. Yeah, that's,
yes, it was a dramatic move, and it was undertaken despite the vigorous opposition of the United States.
I wasn't even aware of that. That's a positive move. Anyway, I want to thank you, Richard.
The fact that you're not aware of it shows how biased the American media is.
Sure. Yeah. And this is a subject I generally endeavor to pay attention to. I totally missed that one. That's incredible. Yeah, it just shows how much the media blackout has kept this kind of important information from us. Anyway, Richard, yeah. I want to encourage you to keep doing what you're doing. This is great. You can make this a more positive world by what you're doing. I'm sure a lot of people are looking to you for positive changes. So, again, keep it up. And once again, folks, check out his website. It's Richard Falk, falk.blogspot.com, correct?
WordPress.com.
Oh, WordPress. Okay, sorry about that.
WordPress.com. But thank you, Charles, for having me on the program. Your questions were very appropriate, and I think we covered a lot of the ground that needs to be covered.
We did. Yeah, in fact, we covered everything I wanted to bring up. So thanks again, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay, folks, have a great week. Next week, we got Richard Gage joining us, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. You don't want to miss that. Be another interesting interview. We'll catch you then. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office of summer people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.